First case is William Pace and Robert Walters versus Hamilton Cove. If we could please have appearances of counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. This is Chris Rogiao from McCarter & English on behalf of defendants.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jeffrey Jacobson as amicus curiae on behalf of the New Jersey Civil Justice Institute.
Good morning, Miriam Edelstein from Castillo, Maines & Silverman on behalf of the plaintiffs.
Good morning, Justices. Stephen Donitis from Donitis O'Sullivan and Prince on behalf of Amicus Curiae, New Jersey Association of Justice.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Rogiao, please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to respectfully request 3 minutes for a brief rebuttal.
That's fine.
This court should reverse the Appellate Division's bright line rule invalidating all class action waivers that are not accompanied by arbitration provisions, and hold that the enforceability of these waivers turns on a case-specific analysis regarding one, whether the waivers were knowing and voluntary, and two, whether they are otherwise unconscionable under factors articulated in Rudbart and discussed in Delta Funding, Arefa, and Muhammad. Application of those factors here warrants enforcement of the waivers and dismissal of plaintiff's class claims. I'd like to highlight 3 points for this court. First, the Appellate Division's bright line rule, which neither party advocated for below, runs contrary to this court's precedent, is not supported by New Jersey case law, and should be reversed. Second, this court should reaffirm the principles articulated in its previous rulings that the appropriate test for the enforceability of class action waivers without arbitration clauses depends on whether they were knowing and voluntary and whether they are otherwise unconscionable under New Jersey law. Third, applying the correct analysis to this case involving class action waivers contained in luxury apartment lease agreements with attorney review provisions, it's evident that the waivers should be enforced. As to my first point, the Appellate Division's decision should be reversed because a general public policy in favor of class actions for low-value claims does not support a blanket rule invalidating all class action waivers simply because they're not accompanied by arbitration provisions. To the contrary, this court and others across the country have repeatedly held that waivers are not unconscionable nor against public policy without arbitration clauses. The Appellate Division's blanket invalidation of class action waivers in this case directly conflicts with this court's ruling in Delta Funding, which held that class action waivers are not per se unconscionable, this court's ruling in Arefa, which enforced a class action waiver that was not linked to an arbitration provision, and well-settled law permitting the waiver of substantive constitutional and procedural rights, such as the right to a jury trial and the right to an appeal. The Appellate Division's bright line rule also isolates New Jersey from other jurisdictions. The majority view from courts across the country, including courts in New York and Pennsylvania, are that class action waivers are valid and enforceable regardless of whether they're accompanied by arbitration provisions. Further, the Appellate Division's opinion here failed to consider that there are alternative means and motivations to a class action for consumers to vindicate their claims, including the CFA's provision for attorney's fees and treble damages. Those provisions incentivize individuals to bring claims and attorneys to take claims. The treble damages and fee shifting provisions also disincentivize businesses from engaging in wrongful conduct. Notably, the CFA does not specifically create a private right to bring a class action. And further, the Appellate Division's holding erodes and ignores the important public policy right of freedom of contract. As to my second point, this court should continue to analyze the enforceability of class action waivers without arbitration clauses under the existing framework set forth in Rudbart and discussed in Arefa, Delta Funding, and Muhammad. This correct framework requires consideration of this court's waiver of rights jurisprudence and whether the waivers are unconscionable as against public policy, because they would effectively preclude a vulnerable and discrete group with low-value claims from ever bringing a lawsuit. Regarding unconscionability, it's only where class action waivers functionally act as exculpatory clauses due to the low value of the claims that the public interest in bringing a class action under the CFA should override the party's freedom of contract rights and permit setting aside a class action waiver. As to my last point, the class action waivers here should be enforced after applying the correct framework. This is not a case involving vulnerable consumers with low-value claims that otherwise would never be brought. Plaintiffs here each entered into 26-month lease agreements for luxury apartments on the Hudson River with rents at over $3,600 a month. The full value of each lease agreement, therefore, over the 26 months is more than $90,000. In this case, Both parties argued below that enforcement turns on the unconscionability analysis discussed in Rudbart. As to the procedural Rudbart factors, I'll note briefly that the plaintiffs were free to rent elsewhere, and any perceived lack of bargaining power was diminished by the attorney review provision, which provided for a 3-day window to have a lawyer study the lease, offer suggested revisions before the lease contract would become binding on the parties. Turning to the most important public interest factor, the amount of damages and demand for injunctive relief in this case closely aligns with the cases at defendant's site, which hold that enforcement of a class action waiver does not impermissibly exculpate a defendant, where the sought-after damages range anywhere from $1,300 to $14,000, include injunctive relief, and permit recovery of attorney's fees, statutory damages, and other punitive damages. Plaintiff's lawsuit in this case alleges that defendants misrepresented the existence of 24/7 security at the premises and seeks relief in the form of treble damages for the difference in value of their $90,000 leases, both with the 24/7 security and without it, attorney's fees, punitive damages, and injunctive relief requiring the defendants to pay for and install additional security measures. Defendants vigorously deny these allegations or that plaintiffs are entitled to any recovery. But nevertheless, it's evident here that plaintiffs have plenty of incentive to bring their claims on an individual basis. And we know this because plaintiffs indicated in their complaint that another individual has filed a lawsuit alleging the same claim on an individual basis. Accordingly, the class action waivers here that plaintiffs indisputably signed can and should be enforced under this court's precedent. The appellate division's decision, therefore, should be reversed.
Counsel, you're done with your opening statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
As a starting point, this appears to be a standard industry form. Is it your position that it is not a contract of adhesion?
Your Honor, there are adhesive elements to this contract, but this is not a contract of adhesion. And we know that because when you look, this court has already said in Stiluti that contracts that have adhesive elements or form contracts are not necessarily contracts of adhesion. In this case, there is an opportunity for attorney review. There is an opportunity to recommend and suggest changes. Some of the provisions indeed were negotiated. Each plaintiff here indicated that they got a couple months free rent. One of the plaintiffs got free parking. So there are different areas which you negotiate. This wasn't the typical take it or leave it contract. And in Stiluti, the court held that it was not, that provision for a gym membership was not a contract of adhesion. And this goes further than that.
Other than price, dates, parking, do you negotiate over the terms of this agreement, this lease agreement?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Other than the rental fee, the term of the lease, and parking as an amenity, does your client negotiate the terms of this lease agreement?
As a general matter, any of the terms here are negotiable. It doesn't mean that the client will accept them. And certainly there's other provisions, including provisions for pets, provision for package acceptance. There's a lot of different provisions that if a tenant was so inclined, they could offer. And so there's
Has your client negotiated over the class action waiver provision in the contract?
So in this case, we include it as part of this agreement. So in this case, the plaintiffs have, there was no negotiation specifically for the class action waiver. However, that's part of the overall factor that goes in the agreement. And so if the plaintiff said, we don't want to agree to the class action waiver, there's nothing that would prohibit our client from considering that and factoring that into the price or a different element.
I'm not asking whether there's anything that would prohibit your client from considering it. I'm asking whether your client has actually negotiated over that particular provision in the lease.
I couldn't say certainly one way or another. I know that it's a part of the lease agreement that can be negotiated as a whole. But as I sit here today, I can't say specifically one way or another that on any given instance they have or have not, Your Honor.
Let's move beyond the form itself. Can you identify for us the public interest considerations that favor allowing waivers of class actions?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I'll turn to the case that we cited, Kinkle versus Singular Wireless, by the Illinois Supreme Court, which is 857 NE2D 250. There, the court noted that there could be a benefit to consumers to enforcing these waivers. Class actions are prohibitively expensive, Your Honor, and incur significant legal costs. If defendants are permitted to enforce class action waivers. They can allocate resources that would be otherwise provided for the defense of class actions to other important features, including reducing the cost of certain products, research and development for new products. So there's certainly a benefit to enforcing the class action waivers, and consumers may actually benefit if the class action waivers are enforced. In addition, I'll note that there is no private right to a class action under the CFA. So there's certainly a benefit to enforcing it for defendants, whereas there's no private right to a class action for plaintiffs.
You cited ARRAFA. Obviously, in ARRAFA, there was an arbitration clause separate from the class action waiver. They weren't in two different places. Do you put ARRAFA in a category in which the arbitration clause is not a factor, as opposed to, you know, the many cases where the class action waiver is integrated into the arbitration clause?
Yes, Your Honor, that's a great question. And I do, because in ARRAFA, the court specifically said that they were enforcing the provision under general contract principles, and they were enforcing the provision that was not linked to an arbitration agreement. And specifically, they said that the class action waiver should be enforced just like the jury trial waiver, under principles of New Jersey contract law. So ARRAFA really supports our position that you don't need an arbitration agreement in order to enforce class action waivers. This court has already considered that position and upheld it.
Would you anticipate that if the appellate division's bright line rule were to be upheld, that parties would routinely go for the arbitration clauses in cases in which landlords would routinely ask for arbitration clauses when they otherwise might not?
I think it's certainly an unintended consequence that could occur as a result of the appellate division's decision here. If businesses know that class action waivers are no longer going to be enforced without arbitration provisions, then that's more incentive to simply include arbitration provisions in their agreements. And if you look at the appellate division's decision, it simply says they're unenforceable absent mandatory arbitration provisions. So the provision itself under the appellate division's decision, doesn't even need to be upheld. The arbitration provision doesn't need to be upheld in order for the class action waivers to be enforceable. It just needs to be mandatory. So if, for example, an arbitration provision doesn't meet the requirements of Attlees or otherwise is unenforceable, under the appellate division's rule, you can still enforce class action waivers. I don't think that really logically makes a lot of sense here, because all theoretically a business needs to do is simply say the claims are governed by arbitration. Okay, and that would, under the appellate division's logic, make the entire class action waiver enforceable, even if the arbitration provision would never be enforceable. So there's a bit of confusion with the appellate division's decision right now. Even though they were trying to create a bright line rule, what is meant by mandatory arbitration? And they said they're not at conflict with Cerciello. We believe they are in conflict with Cerciello, but in any event, if the arbitration provision is unenforceable, but the class action waivers are, I think that undermines the appellate division's decision. I think our position is we should be viewing class action waivers that are not accompanied by arbitration provisions under New Jersey contract principles, under Rudbart, and under waiver of rights principles, which is, I think, what ARRAFA did.
How do you value the claim here if plaintiffs were to prevail?
So in our brief, we took a conservative estimate. We looked at what we do know. And in the complaint, we know that these are 26-month lease agreements at $3,600 a month. So the full value of the total pot of money at issue is $90,000. That's significant. The way we valued the claims is we took the most conservative approach. Plaintiffs say the 24/7 security was a significant aspect of their leases. Nevertheless, we said, let's estimate that they're claiming a 2% reduction in their leases for the failure to have 24/7 security. Even a 2% reduction, which is very, very conservative and very, very small, we anticipate the plaintiffs will say it's more than that, a 2% reduction generates a claim of $1,800 and then trebled, it's over $5,600. So once you get to a $5,600 just damage claim, that doesn't even account for the attorney's fees, the injunctive relief. The value of these claims here are significant, and they're not so low value, such as the cases discussed in Muhammad, such as the circumstances discussed in Muhammad, that would preclude a plaintiff from bringing a claim. We have the special civil part. Claims in excess of $5,000 fall squarely within the special civil part and can be vindicated there.
I'm not asking whether your firm would take this case, but would a firm like yours take a $5,600 case?
I think a firm would, absolutely. Just like mine, a mid-sized firm, or even a solo practitioner. That's what the CFA incentivizes with their treble damages provisions and the attorney's fees provisions. If we had a slam dunk case, Your Honor, a $5,600 case that was slam dunk is absolutely worth taking under CFA because of the treble damages provisions and because of the attorney's fees provision. And I think that's the purpose of the CFA, and that's the purpose of those provisions, is to incentivize attorneys to bring claims, even if they're not over $100,000, but still, they're significant in value. They're not the $40 diet drug claim in Lee versus Carter Reed. They're not the $200 payday loan in Muhammad. This is much more significant than that.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
At this point, Your Honor, I'd just like to reinforce the principle that this court has permitted waiver of substantive constitutional rights, including the right to a jury trial and the right to an appeal. The right to a class action, there is no formal right to a class action. There's a permissive right that's provided by the rules. And there is no reason why we should elevate the right to a class action over the waiver of rights for a jury trial or the waiver of rights to an appeal, which are constitutional rights, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We'll have you back for rebuttal. Mr. Jacobson.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. It's a little hard to comprehend what happened here. This court in Delta Funding and Muhammad had clearly held that there is no per se rule against class action waivers and contracts. So for the appellate division to have created a per se rule here without mentioning Delta Funding and Muhammad is odd, to say the least. And they're brushing away of Cerciello, where another appellate division panel had basically followed Muhammad and Delta Funding is also a little odd. I have a modest ask, which is that the court should follow its own decisions in Muhammad. What it did in Muhammad on the same day as Delta Funding was say that if a class action waiver amounts to an exculpatory clause, if it becomes such that by virtue of upholding the class action waiver, you are turning it into a waiver of the right to bring a suit under this Consumer Fraud Act, that would be unconscionable and unenforceable under New Jersey law. But you have to look at these on an individual basis. I think that's exactly the rule that you follow here. And I think the easy part is deciding that the appellate division got this wrong. The harder part is deciding where you send the case and with what instructions. Do you have enough in the record to uphold the class action waivers right here? My colleague says you do, and I tend to agree with him, but I think that there's a case to be made on the other side of that. You could have the appellate division take a look at this through the lens of through the lens of Muhammad. I think they'll just end up saying, wait a minute, didn't the trial court say that they've pleaded enough to suggest that there's unconscionability and let's have some discovery? They might send it back down. I think that's the harder part the court has to consider here. But I respectfully submit that the easy part is deciding that this has to be a case-by-case analysis.
Mr. Jacobson, one of the striking things about the appellate division decision to me is that they seem to have decided class certification. And I, correct me if I'm wrong, this is at a preliminary stage, there has been no motion to certify a class, but the court seems to find certification to be appropriate, despite the court rule not having been complied with.
they certainly touted the virtues of the possibility of the case becoming a class action. I don't think they went through the factors that would have allowed it, but they definitely were whistling a happy tune in the direction of class certification. But I think that my colleague would say that they're a long way from getting class certification for a lot of reasons. And by the way, Chief Justice, I think you asked a very good question about would a law firm take this case for a few thousand dollars. Respectfully, I'm not sure that's the right question, because as we've seen in the mass arbitration world, when arbitration clauses are, when class action waivers are part of arbitration agreements, what would happen here in the real world is if there were a lot of tenants of this building who felt similarly aggrieved by virtue of the security features that are being complained of here, you would have a law firm that would be going door to door and lining up hundreds of plaintiffs. And if the defendant wanted to have 100 of these cases, then you've got 100 of these cases. And that's basically what the consequence of upholding this would be. So there is a be careful what you wish for consequence here. But as Mr. Denitis will tell you, he and I are doing this all over the place with regard to mass arbitration as well. So I don't think that there's anything close to exculpation here by virtue of upholding this clause. I think that if there is, if this is a one-off kind of complaint, it'll go the way of one-off kinds of complaints. If it's not, other things will happen, and you know it may not return to this court. But the per se rule is, as I say, impossible to defend here, given the way cases all over the country have been deciding this. And Justice Patterson, I will beat my favorite drum of the Truth in Consumer Contract Warranty and Notice Act. If it were really true that there is a per se rule that we should have been seeing all along here against class action waivers, then you might see this case amended to include a $100 per tenant claim in addition, because you would have a provision in this contract that would be unconscionable and unenforceable under New Jersey law, which is why in our brief, we suggested that if the court actually were to uphold the per se rule, it make clear that this is prospective only, so that businesses have an opportunity to adjust contracts like this that are enforceable all over the country to make sure they don't end up with a tick winner problem in New Jersey.
Other questions, anyone? Mr. Jacobson, anything else?
No, I just want to thank your honors for allowing me to participate and for adjusting this way to the weather, although it gives me a little PTSD to 2020. It's nice to see you all this way, so thank you.
Pleasure to have you all. Ms. Edelstein.
Thank you. Good morning again, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices. May it please the court. We do urge that this court affirm both the orders of the appellate division, as well as the trial court, in denying the defendant's motion to dismiss the class allegations as unenforceable under New Jersey law and public policy, under both the standard applied by the appellate division, as well as the Red Bart test applied by the trial court. We do urge the court to affirm the bright line rule articulated by the appellate division that class action waivers outside of arbitration are per se unconscionable under New Jersey's public policy, as necessary to protect the important public interests that underlie New Jersey's public policy favoring class actions in cases that do meet the requirements of Rule 432-1. We also believe if the court believes a bright line rule is inappropriate, under the test and articulated in Rudbart and Mohammed, which is what the trial court used, we also meet, based on the pleadings, the factors required to show unconscionability under the court's test in those cases. We do believe that this is an issue of first impression. Class action waivers where there is no consideration of an arbitration provision, no possibility of private mandatory arbitration. This is a class action waiver that envisions that any claims will be brought in the courts of New Jersey, specifically in Hudson County, as the contracts are written, selecting the venue where the building is in Hudson County. The two realities of what will happen if a case that will be brought in the courts of New Jersey, if they are forced to be individual claims and class action as a procedure under Rule 432, is not available to the parties or the court, then one of two things will happen. In cases like this one, we submit that we disagree with the defendant's, what we believe, very speculative calculation of the damages available at this point. We are essentially still at the pleading stage in terms of this court's review of this motion. There has also
question as to what percentage of the rent is implicated.
So the percentage cited by defense, I don't know where that percentage comes from. We have suggested nothing like that.
We heard from your adversary that they were trying to be low and pick 2% as the low end of significant. This is sort of the what I gleaned from that. I know that the case is early, but you do have an allegation with respect to the impact of the security issue on your clients' decisions to rent these apartments.
Yeah.
And so do you have a percentage number in mind, understanding that that there may be a possibility that it goes higher, but as to what you would think the case is worth?
We do not have a percentage in mind. What we believe is appropriate for accurate and meeting our burden of proof of demonstrating ascertainable loss is to get discovery, which we have requested, but much of it has been stayed, on how the defense actually did factor in amenities, specifically the security features that they did provide. We do allege that they provided some. What they did not provide was all of what they promised. We also need to do discovery to know exactly how much of that security. We do have allegations that towards the beginning of the leases, there was at least one person at the front desk for a little less than half the time. And towards the later part of the leases, more than half the time. If we say on average, perhaps the defense provided half of the security that they promised, we do need discovery to know how the defense calculated across 573 units. And in those units, however many people were signatories on the leases. And in the case of our named plaintiffs, each of them were occupying a unit with their respective spouses. So I would say conservatively across 573 units, some of them having more than one occupant who would be a putative class member. Just from my layperson Googling, it seems that providing a 24/7 unarmed security guard would run perhaps about $15,000 to $20,000 per month. If we say that the defense, we don't know, but if the defense had passed that cost entirely through and dispersed it across all the units, we'd be looking at something between $20 to $25 a month, and even multiplying that by the 26-month lease length of the two plaintiffs here, we would get to a total ascertainable loss of somewhere around $200. Trebling that for under the CFA, we would get to somewhere around $600. But these are quite speculative at this point. However, I do think they're more realistic in terms of how we would need to demonstrate the actual loss. If the defense did use a percentage of the rent, then we need to know that. However, that's not what we anticipated. And we will need experts once we have the information to be able to adequately show how the pass-through would work. Had they provided the other half of the security that was promised.
Why are the only two alternatives that are being presented here, one, not bringing the claim, and two, a class action? When we don't have 10,000 plaintiffs here, we have you said 573 units, whether all those people would be involved, obviously not certain of that, but it is a number that the New Jersey courts handle. And of course, the New Jersey courts deal with aggregated separate claims that run into the tens of thousands at times. So why isn't there, many law firms, and you know, you come from a very experienced law firm, are set up to deal with multiple aggregate claims, and ultimately, if the case is going to be resolved, do an aggregate settlement of the entire claim without a class action. Why is that not a viable option for these individuals to bring a claim if they so choose?
I would say for the reasons expressed in the class action rule, which is, we believe this court has expressed many times, that public policy of New Jersey, promoting the fair and efficient administration of justice, the 432-1 and 432-2 provide numerous and stringent requirements to demonstrate that it's appropriate to go forward as a class action.
And I understand that. And there's certainly a public policy in favor of class actions. But under Rudbart, the question is whether this an important question is whether this waiver, which you are asking be struck down, although your clients signed it, is exculpatory to the defendants. It means game over. And that's certainly the suggestion of the appellate division decision. What I'm asking is whether you acknowledge that there are aggregated there are methods of aggregation of litigation that are not class actions, but are also effective methods by which multiple lawsuits are brought in an economical and efficient way.
Yes, certainly. However, the test for a class action requires that the plaintiff show superiority. So regardless of the availability of other methods, the class action waivers here, because we're really only contemplating cases that are going to be brought in court, only become relevant when there is a class that would otherwise be appropriate for class certification and class treatment. And it's only going to be appropriate when the plaintiff demonstrates superiority, regardless of any other methods available.
And I understand superiority is part of the second half of the steps that the court would take in ultimately determining class certification. But can you say that this is ultimately exculpatory? You know, if for example, going back to a case involving vitamins that don't work, obviously a case that this court's previously seen, somebody spent $5. And ultimately, by the time you bring an individual lawsuit, in the first 5 minutes of that lawsuit, the $5 is gone. This is not quite that. This is a tenant lawsuit, potentially multiple tenants, potentially hundreds of tenants. And my question is not whether class action is superior or not, but whether you can make the argument, given the precedent for multiple tenant lawsuits in New Jersey that have been handled by the courts on many occasions as an aggregate, can you really say that if this is enforced, it means the game is over? There is no lawsuit.
Effectively, I do believe that's what we see in the support, particularly cited by the amicus brief from Public Justice, National Association for Consumer Advocates, National Center for Consumer Law. Effectively, if I am correct, and the claims here are indeed, even with treble damages, something at most $1,000 per plaintiff, or even if the defense turns out to be correct and it's more like $5,000 per plaintiff, it does not seem that there are enough sophisticated plaintiffs who would know that they can bring this action, first of all. It's one of the things that the class action procedure supports is the broader enforcement of the Consumer Fraud Act and other remedial statutes. And this is a point where we differ from defense. We do believe that this court has stated numerous times that there is a private right to bring a class action that's encouraged for appropriate cases under the Consumer Fraud Act.
I would understand if it was a case where a plaintiff perhaps had lost $5, didn't know they had lost it. It was part of a cell phone contract or something that the plaintiff didn't pay any attention to. But in answering Justice Patterson's questions before, you were arguing that you would have to prove ascertainable loss for every individual plaintiff, which is the idea that it actually mattered to each individual plaintiff that they only rented this apartment because there was a certain promise of security, and then they were actually harmed by the fact that they didn't receive the quantum of security that was promised. How could that possibly be something that an unsophisticated plaintiff would miss? I thought the whole point of the argument here is that it was vital to each person signing the lease, and then it fundamentally harmed them when they didn't receive it.
So I'd like to clarify what I do believe that our named plaintiffs, and we have alleged this sufficiently, significantly relied on the fraudulent, what we allege to be fraudulent misrepresentations in deciding to sign the lease. We have never put forward the position that the biggest value of the lease was the promise of 24/7 security, or that they did not seek to void the contracts entirely based on the lack of fulfilling a promise of 24/7 security. The class action rule supports several public interests, common collective rights. This is where we do think that it differs from the court's analysis for things like jury waivers, jury trial waivers, rights of appeal. These are all individual rights. When the court is, even rights that are enshrined as constitutional rights, they are individual rights that a person can waive if the factors are met under the court's test. However, the public policy arguments that we do think support a broader rule for class actions being available in cases where they are appropriate.
There's nothing in the class action rule that says a class action must be brought, correct? It is just a class action may be brought under the following circumstances.
That's true. But because one of the required elements is demonstrating that it's a superior method, and there are several cases from this court finding that it is a superior method for adjudicating specifically small monetary value consumer action claims, not just as low as $5 or $40. The case that's most often cited as saying that you can find that a class action waiver is enforceable, Delta Funding, you're talking about a $100,000 claim. And still we're talking about the arbitration scheme. There is a significant difference, we believe, that supports the broader rule, where you're dealing with a case that's definitely going to be brought in court if it's brought at all. And so what you have is the ability of the rule to protect the interests of judicial economy and fair and efficient administration of justice, not just for the putative class members, but for all litigants in the court who will have a significant delay of justice if there are 573 individual actions brought rather than a class action, that the court has an extremely large amount of procedural tools to control exactly how that case proceeds all the way through, including after a jury verdict. The 432-2, even after all of the stringent requirements have been met to certify a class, if you go all the way through litigation, you get a judgment. If it turns out it was inappropriate to assess damages on a class-wide basis, the court can decertify the class or order a new trial. That was held in Little just a few years ago.
But if this all comes down to general public policy arguments or fair administration of justice arguments, how do you respond to your adversary's position that because class action waivers, as long as there's also an arbitration provision, are automatically enforceable under binding United States Supreme Court precedent that this court is bound to follow, that it will actually have the opposite effect on public policy rather than the one that you are advocating? And instead, it will just mean that every contract that included a class action waiver will now also require binding arbitration.
Well, I think that the reason that this is a case of first impression is because we are pretty much there.
When you say a case of first impression, are you saying no court anywhere has ever considered a class action waiver without an arbitration clause?
Under New Jersey state law, I'm not aware of any.
Just meant in New Jersey.
I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
So this appears to us not to be an outlier of how a court should handle this question under New Jersey law. This is an outlier in the context that exists in this case. I have never encountered a class action waiver outside without an arbitration provision. I think my co-counsel can speak to his experience a little broader than mine. I think he's encountered maybe one or two. This is already there, and we understand the result.
There? I'm confused. What's the there that this is? Your adversary was arguing that we would go back, I guess, to a time where every time there was a class action waiver, there was also a requirement to go to binding arbitration if courts hold that class action waivers are only enforceable if there's also a requirement to go to arbitration. So what's the there as to where we are now, or why we wouldn't be able to go back to where your adversary is saying that we would be going?
I fully anticipate when I see a class action waiver that there is an arbitration provision. It is surprising to me to find a standalone class action waiver. I do believe that is because parties who draft these agreements, and this is a form waiver. Mr. Chief Justice, remarked on it appearing to be a form, and defense acknowledges parts of it are certainly the class action waiver addendum with the NAA logo at the top right and New Jersey form class action waiver footer at the bottom. This is a form. This is what we do expect to see already. And we understand that New Jersey does also have a strong public policy that favors arbitration. So the result that defense and defense amicus warn of, that we'll see from now on only class action waivers where there's mandatory arbitration, we already expect to see that. And that is a result that is also in accord with New Jersey public policy. The issue here that we think, or the factors here that we think support a rule that says—
Sorry, so you're saying that it would be better. This is all, your argument is based solely on public policy, as far as I understand. And you're saying from a public policy perspective, it would be better for everyone to be pushed into arbitration with a class action waiver rather than a standalone class action waiver that does not include a requirement of arbitration, because we're only talking about public policy. So from a public policy perspective, which of those is the better public policy outcome in your view?
Well, my opinion is it is better to have access to the courts. However, I understand New Jersey's public policy to strongly support arbitration, but that is not a bad thing. I also understand New Jersey public policy to say class actions, when they are appropriate under the rule, are also a good thing. So,
New Jersey also has a general public policy that supports the right to contract, right? That people can sign contracts to rent apartments, to buy items that they want, et cetera.
That is the public policy on the side of the defense. We absolutely acknowledge that. However, the freedom of contract, this court has held many times, is not limitless. And one of the limits is the argument we make here, which is where the balance of that public policy, which is a public policy, however, a private interest here, the benefit would be only to the parties to that contract, whereas the detriment is what the courts test in Rudbart and Muhammad require that we look at. And the detriment is to the harm of the collective rights of the putative class members, the risk of inconsistent treatment, the risk to judicial economy, to all litigants who are trying to access the courts.
But given that all of that can already happen with arbitration, I'm just trying to understand why you think it's better to end up in a world where all of these cases are subject to binding arbitration.
It is not that I think it is better that they all wind up in binding arbitration. However, if you are not going to allow, if you're going to enforce a class action waiver and not have that available where it would otherwise be certified and superior as a class action, then it does seem to me that a court is a more difficult place to litigate claims that would otherwise be certified as a class, if not for the waiver. And that it would be easier to, for the reasons expressed in Concepcion, administer the type of mass arbitration claims that we are seeing now. More difficult for the courts and for all litigants to try to fashion, I think, as Justice Patterson says, it is possible. But I do think that where the class action is superior, which we have to demonstrate to get access to that rule, then it is more difficult to litigate what should otherwise be a class action in court rather than in private arbitration.
I'm puzzled by this argument. I know that amici who are not here today have advanced it. And it boils down to, if you uphold the appellate division, don't expect to see us in court. We're going to be going the route of arbitration. In plain language, how is that relevant to the legal question this appeal presents?
I don't believe it. I believe that it is not relevant to whether New Jersey's public policy as it is prohibits class action waivers for cases that are going to be brought in court where there's no arbitration. I think that those are policy arguments that perhaps may be made in lobbying the legislature to change policy. But it is already the policy of this court to strongly favor class actions where they meet the requirements, and particularly for small monetary value Consumer Fraud Act claims.
Let me ask you something, because you've stressed that you have many, many steps to go through to certify this class. You've got to go through the 4432 requirements, two sets of them, and part of the second set is under B1 is superiority. But let me just read you a couple of lines from the appellate division. Bearing in mind there has been no motion for class certification, there's been no class discovery, that this is what the appellate division says. Assuming the facts alleged by plaintiffs are true, a class action is clearly favored in this matter. Hundreds of tenants at Hamilton Cove are similarly affected by the lack of promised security. Economic efficiency and judicial economy would be enhanced by the utilization of class action litigation, and inconsistent results would be avoided. That's the appellate division statement. And then it goes on to say, having found that this is an appropriate case for a class certification, which is not the issue before it, as I understand the posture before it. It then goes on to say that shows we have this strong policy in place here toward class actions. And I think you have properly said, we're not there yet, that we've had, this is preliminary, this is years away potentially, and there are many steps that you would have to go through in order to get there. But the appellate division's decision is premised in part on a what it comes out with, a very definitive statement that this is a proper case for class certification. And that's why I began asking your adversary, what am I missing here? Because this is not before the court, and yet it is an underpinning of the appellate division statement that this is the right case to vindicate a public policy, because class action, this should be a class action. You see what I'm saying?
I do. The way that I read that language, and I agree, especially the language that you read towards the end, it does, it sounds like they are perhaps getting the cart ahead of the horse, but remember that we are at the motion to dismiss stage, motion to dismiss class actions. And so I do think that they were, that it was under that standard, under the standard in Baskin v. PC Richard and Son, where there is a possibility to move to dismiss class claims at the pleading stage before you're ready to get into the full motion for cert analysis. However, perhaps it's more strongly stated and.
But that's not the basis for this motion here. And I understand that your factual allegations can and should be and are taken to be true for purposes of the motion to dismiss. But we're not in that world when they make this statement about this class ought to be certified. We are in the issue of what's the public policy here. And they have made a determination that is an underpinning of their analysis that this is an appropriate class for class cert. And I'm not in any way faulting you. You didn't move for class certification, nor did you argue before them that let's just skip over a whole bunch of stuff and certify the class as an appropriate class. But that, to me, is a peculiar way of going about this for the appellate division, by finding the public policy in this case favors a class action because it's an appropriate class for it's an appropriate situation for class certification. It seems like an odd premise for their overall Rudbart determination.
I think that there are some factors that are comparable in the Rudbart analysis with some of the factors that are required to demonstrate appropriateness for a class action that can overlap, and perhaps there is some conflation there. However, certainly we do not read the appellate division's decision to solely be based on their. I'll say I think that is their analysis of whether we have stated sufficient allegations to maintain a class at the pleading stage.
I would think if you were to go back to the trial court and go through a certification process in this case, it would be awfully tempting not to waive the appellate division's decision at the trial court and say the appellate division says this is a proper class. And I think obviously it's important for appellate courts to look at what's before them. And I just wanted to flag that for you.
Understood. I do hear the justice's questions to the extent that the court thinks that a bright line rule is too broad of a move. What we think that is based on, and again, defense is correct. We did not ask for one, but in reading the appellate division's decision, it makes sense to us. Not because there has been a prior rule enunciated by this court, as we say, we don't think this specific issue has been decided, but because this is the outlier that in our view, this situation, and because we see when we look at a balancing of the equities, the public interest on one side of a private enforcing a private contract versus the public interest on the other side, not just of a strong policy interest favoring class actions for appropriate cases, of broadening the enforcement power of the Consumer Fraud Act by enabling private attorneys general, but also for all of the purposes of the class action rule itself and those specific policies that it advances, the judicial economy of the courts, danger to the defendants of inconsistent results. One of the things we do ask for here is injunctive relief. Certainly, if you know we were to win equitable remedy of requiring some implementation of additional security measures at a building, it would impact everyone in that building, even if there were to be a different result in another case.
Go ahead. Please finish your answer. Go ahead.
I think one of the reasons that the appellate division was looking to the class action rule was because those factors themselves are numerous safeguards that we have to meet and that protect defendants from the danger of frivolous or inappropriate class claims throughout the life of litigation.
Can you comment on a passage toward the end of the appellate division decision we haven't touched on yet? It's where the court speaks generally about not enforcing contractual provisions that dismantle or disable important procedures and due process rights in the rules. Does this case implicate due process?
I believe when you get to decisions that could have a res judicata effect on class members who may not bring forth claims or who may get different results if they do all bring individual claims, that could endanger due process rights of those potential litigants. I believe
that's a due process argument against a class action, not in favor of one, right?
I'm sorry. I think that's arguing in favor of a class action so that there are no rights. A person can opt out of a class action. As they don't have to go along with the class action. However, if they do, then they are knowingly choosing to have an individual claim that's litigated. If we go forward with individual claims that still could have a preclusive effect on the same exact issue that comes up on another plaintiff's case, I think that could be a problem in terms of due process, just in terms of who gets there first.
Arguing that there could be issue preclusion used in a case with separate parties. So it's different plaintiffs bringing the same claim against this defendant. You're arguing that there would be issue preclusion from one claim to the next?
Perhaps not full issue preclusion.
It couldn't be claim preclusion because it's a different plaintiff, right?
It couldn't be issue preclusion.
It couldn't be claim preclusion because it's a different plaintiff, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So where would the be? I'm sorry, can you explain then what the preclusion would be?
If there were factual findings that were made and conclusions of law based on those factual findings, in what would otherwise be this common questions of fact and law that would otherwise be dealt with altogether in a class action?
But this would only be if there was no class action, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So it's the danger of inconsistent results. Is there
case law out there that elevates this to a due process context?
I'm not aware of it.
Please go ahead.
So I would like to just reiterate our argument. If the court does go through the analysis of Rudbart and Mohammed, I think the adhesive nature of the contract is visible just facially from the contract. It was presented to them. They had to sign it when it was presented to them. It gave them a 3-day period in June of 2020 for William Pace. That was during the still during the statewide shutdown.
But it was presented to them and they had to sign it. It's a situation where this is very expensive housing. It's luxury housing. I think everybody agrees. Presumably your clients and others look at multiple apartments on the Hudson or elsewhere that are potentially comparable. And they're presented a contract that can be canceled in 3 days based on attorney review. What does it mean to say it was presented to them and they had to sign it?
They had 3 days to sign it. And a 3 day review period.
But if they wanted to rent a different luxury apartment, they could have, correct?
Yes, we have cited authority from this court over several years, noting an ongoing housing shortage in northern New Jersey, that was only exacerbated during the pandemic at a time when it was vital, it's always vital, but extra vital to know where you're going to live and to have your house, as most people needed a place to quarantine, to isolate.
But again, this is luxury housing. So are you saying there was a shortage of luxury housing available for these individuals to find?
Luxury housing is how they advertised it. And certainly it's not HUD housing. However, there is a shortage of rentals. This is not rent, sadly. I tried to find some sources for median rents. I found some in Hoboken. This is median rent.
Median rent in Hoboken.
In Hoboken.
Right, overlooking Manhattan. I mean, so the idea that your clients were put in a position where they had no choice but to sign, potentially had no choice but to sign this lease after the review period, after the ability to consult with attorneys in order to live in a place where many people don't have the ability or opportunity to, it's a difficult argument to understand.
So I don't think that the, I think that that goes to the economic compulsion, which is one of the three minor factors after you determine whether under Rudbarton Muhammad. The first question is it a contract of adhesion? Regardless of the fact that these plaintiffs and the putative plaintiffs, no, they are not living at the poverty level. They have money to rent the apartments that were advertised here. That does not make them sophisticated on a footing with
Are you arguing that your clients were subject to economic compulsion, as that factor has been talked about in other distinct settings?
Not to the same degree whatsoever.
Let me just be clear. Are you arguing that your clients, who could evidently afford a very expensive apartment, were subject to economic compulsion by after looking at an apartment and having the landlord's representative hand them a contract, and they have 3 days to sign it or not sign it?
Not based on their income level, but it's based on the necessity, the nature of the good itself.
But it seems like then what you're arguing is that all contracts for luxury apartment units should never be enforceable. No provisions of them will ever be enforceable, because you talk about three different factors: the relationship between a commercial real estate business and two prospective tenants is inherently unequal. That seems like it would be the case in any large apartment, luxury apartment complex. Number two, the subject matter of the agreement was to provide housing. That will also be the case in every luxury apartment complex. And then number three, a degree of economic compulsion was present because the necessity of housing and its impacts on an individual's everyday life incentivized plaintiffs to agree to Hamilton Cove's terms. Again, it seems like that will be the case in any luxury apartment rental. So I'm just not sure, aside from a large luxury apartment complex that's handwriting the lease in consultation with every prospective tenant who comes in, which I think most likely does not exist anywhere, how would these leases ever be enforceable?
So we are not saying that the lease itself is not enforceable. The most important factor under Rudbart and Muhammad is the fourth one, the weighing of public policy interests. We do put forward what we believe are valid arguments under the first three, but they get short mention, and this court has said they deserve short mention. The most important factor is balancing the potential harm to public policy interests, if it's enforceable, if it's enforced, or if it's not enforced. And it's the balancing of those harms. All of the factors that I cited that you just recited, Justice Wehner-Apter, are predominantly, from our point of view, establishing the adhesive nature of the contract. The thrust of the question under Rudbart and Muhammad is, where is the balance of weighing the public policy interest identified in enforcing the specific waiver, not the lease, the class action waiver, versus the potential detriment of enforcing the class action waiver? And we do argue that it would be contrary to New Jersey public policy that outweighs the private public interest, public policy interest, for a private party enforcing their contract provision versus the public policy interests that are advanced when the court is and the litigants are permitted to use the class action procedure for cases that are brought in court.
In view of the time, I wanted to check if others had questions. Anyone else? Ms. Edelstein, anything you'd like to add to your argument?
I would like to add, just to finish up the, if the court does not uphold a rule, that we do think that the Rudbart and Muhammad test is what applies here, just absent that prism of any arbitration considerations that weigh against the public policy interest in allowing access to class actions, and that we are still at the pleading stage for purposes of this appeal. We've had extremely limited initial written discovery limited to individual claims. So we do think that it's appropriate to affirm the rulings from the lower courts under any analysis that the court uses.
Do you think the court should depart from Delta funding?
I don't think that it would be a departure from the holding of Delta funding, which was that class arbitration waivers are not unenforceable per se. And it was a case dealing with an acknowledged claim that would be at least $100,000 in value. For small monetary amount consumer claims, we think that it would be in line with Delta and Muhammad, decided on the same day, to find that this waiver was unenforceable when the court balances the public policy interests.
But we, just one thing, but we don't know any of that yet. We don't know if this is a small value claim. We're not going to know what the value of this claim is and whether it's appropriate under Delta funding until that kind of discovery occurs, correct?
We're not going to be able to meet a burden to show that. I can't, you know, if the court decides that there's not enough specificity in the complaint, we can certainly amend it to show what we think is plausible under what we do know, but we do need discovery to know exactly a more accurate estimate of what the named plaintiff's ascertainable loss is.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Denitas.
May it please the court, Justice Rabder and justices of the court. I'm here on behalf of New Jersey Association of Justice, which the court knows is a consumer group looking out for the interests of consumer litigants, tort claim litigants with tort claims, with litigants with employee claims, and protecting their access to the courts. In seeing the questions from the court today, and also the arguments of the defendant, it seems that everyone seems to recognize that small claims that by persons that are subject to contracts of adhesion, if a class action waiver was enforceable, it would preclude persons' ability to get to the courthouse. This idea of freedom of contract, which while it is a very important policy interest, it's not absolute. And New Jersey courts for over 60 years have recognized that in various ways. If a contract limits someone's right under the New Jersey court rules to bring a counterclaim, if it limits someone's right to depositions, if an attorney wishes to charge more than the court rules suggest, they're not allowed to do that. And courts have recognized the importance going back to 1972 under Riley versus New Rapids that class actions serve, that they enable people who might be disadvantaged, somebody who has small claims where it's just not economical to bring a claim individually, either for themselves or in the ability to get an attorney, they are in effect foreclosed from the courthouse. I could see the court wrestling in this case. Does this fit into that analysis? So when we look at Muhammad, while Muhammad did not set forth an expressed bright line rule stating that all class action waivers are unenforceable, when you look at how class actions proceed and what cases are ideally suited for class treatment, its practical effect in some ways does create a bright line rule. And the reason why I say that is most class actions by their nature and several cases acknowledge this, they go forward as class actions because it's not economically feasible or efficient to go forward as an individual action. And so you oftentimes, most of your class actions involve small claims. And so when you look at Muhammad, if it's a person that's subject to a contract of adhesion, which unfortunately nowadays everyone is, whether they know it or not, between your cell phone contracts, your Comcast contracts, your buying things on Amazon, buying things on retail. Everyone, including the justices, myself, we have all entered into contracts of adhesion, even though we might be sophisticated, even though we might have wealth or non-wealth. There's a contracts that we enter into, unfortunately, with the advent of electronics, advent of buying things online. There's oftentimes not the ability to negotiate contracts, and that's occurring more and more. And from New Jersey Association Justices' perspective, a concern here in this case is a blanket ruling that class action waivers are enforceable in court. Because if that were the case, it would preclude not only the disadvantaged and small claims, but even people who may not be disadvantaged that agree to agreements that they have no choice. If you wish to buy a cell phone in this state, I can tell you every single one of them have a class action waiver in their agreement. And it's not negotiable. It's take it or leave it.
I think your co-counsel, Ms. Edelstein, did not ask for a ruling that class action waivers outside of arbitration are never enforceable. There's no request here for the appellate division for this bright line rule. I'm not hearing from the other side that every class action waiver, other than the one that may be integrated in an arbitration agreement, must be enforceable. I don't hear that happening.
No, I agree.
So I think the what we're here to review is the appellate division's decision that imposed a very broad bright line rule for policy reasons that the appellate division expressed. But I think it's a bit of a straw man to say that the other side is saying every time something has over it class action waiver, that this court is being asked to say, oh no, that sounds great with us. I think
I appreciate that, Justice. No, I appreciate that. I tend to agree. And that was part of my argument, and I don't really think I need to express that too much. But just going to the bright line rule, while I agree there is not a bright line rule expressed anywhere in any case, Muhammad with small claims could potentially be viewed as that if it is a contract of adhesion. Because as with Delta funding and as was argued with Delta funding, you typically have cases that are $100,000 that come before, that go forward as a class action. But to Justice Rabner's question, Chief Justice Rabner's question, in a case like this that potentially has a $5,000 claim, and we don't know if it's $5,000, to Justice Solomon's point, with this factual record and one of the, in preparing for argument today and working on the briefs, it's really hard on this factual record to know a couple things. One, is this a complete contract of adhesion? It certainly has elements of it, but is it a complete contract of adhesion? And two, what is the value of this claim? And I would concede we don't actually know. It appears to be a small damages claim, but it, that fact makes it somewhat hard to determine this case at this juncture one way or the other. I'm not advocating necessarily that there needs to be discovery in every single case, but I think this case highlights it is a little bit of a tougher question based on how the justices are looking at it and based on the arguments. I could tell you cases that are under $10,000 as a class action practitioner in this state for 27 years, even if they're $10,000, we don't proceed with cases that are under $10,000, even with fee shifting, if you can't pursue as a class action in a case specifically like this, because this case is going to require a couple experts, most likely on damages, and it's just going to be costly. And it doesn't look like it's going to be a very high value damages claim, and it's going to be very difficult to pursue. So, you know, from that respect, it could preclude claims. However, to Justice Patterson's point, can't you proceed with a case like this on, in the aggregate? And so there are cases that do proceed as aggregate claims in MDLs, but those cases are typically mass torts where the case, the value per case is in oftentimes in the hundreds of thousands. And so you typically don't see cases brought on behalf of a mass number of plaintiffs, not as a class action, that are $5,000 to $10,000 claims. I could tell you from a war story that I had the opportunity to do that. I had a case of 48 homeowners. We were attempting to proceed as a class action, and the court denied the class action without prejudice and said, well, I don't see why you can't proceed with 48 people individually. So we did. The cases were 10,000 apiece. We had to have an expert for every case because it wasn't a class action. We had 48 sets of interrogatories, 48 sets of document requests, 48 depositions of every plaintiff. And at the end of the day, the court said, well, you know, after they saw how much work it was, saying, well, maybe we should have at least granted a test case because that might have been easier, because it created so much more litigation, not only for the plaintiffs, but admittedly for the defendants as well, that I think at the end of the day, they would have preferred a class action. So, I mean, a class action isn't a dirty word. It's just the ability of a number of claims that are can't be impractically joined to proceed.
But our issue here, I mean, part of the issue that we have to look at is we're not here to judge whether class action is the right thing for this case or the class actions generally. Yeah. That's not what the case is about. The class action, this is a case about a signed waiver of the right to bring a class action. And therefore, we are not simply, obviously, with great deference to your experience in handling it, and you know, certainly there are economies with a class action, but there also can be, class actions can be very non-economical. And ultimately, you know, there are debates about whether the individuals in many class actions actually end up with very much of value, because of the cost of a mass case like that. So that's not our issue. Our issue is whether this waiver is unenforceable, as the appellate division found, having made a determination that this was a correct case for class action treatment, and having said that the policy behind class actions require that we strike that down. That's a different issue than, you know, an appeal of, we don't get them often, but every so often we do of a class certification decision. See what I'm saying?
I do. I absolutely do, Justice Patterson. And part of the issue that I think if you to look at this contract on its face, and again, I think to what Justice Solomon pointed out, there's not a lot of a factual record. So on its face, what we know is it's a 47-page lease, single-spaced, which frankly, that's a long lease, even for a luxury apartment complex. While they have the 3-day right of attorney review, we don't know if it was really negotiable or not. We don't know if they were really willing to negotiate or not. That's just not in the record. We don't know how many other apartments were really available or not available. We know it's more likely that claims in this case are smaller damages than large damages. I mean, if it's a $43,000 a year lease for this apartment complex, you know, some fraction of that would go towards security, but certainly not the majority of it. So if they were going to, if the case is about providing that service that wasn't promised, you know, just looking at it on its face, it doesn't appear to be a large damages claim. So if it's not a large damages claim, it's a 47-page lease that the person had to electronically sign. We don't know if it was able to be really negotiated or not. If even if it was for a sophisticated person, that would be a lot to negotiate. And, you know, even the class action waiver was not even in the table of contents. And so, again, I understand what the court is grappling with. It is, you know, they are a luxury, but I would say this absolutely tends to be more of a contract of adhesion and a place where at a minimum, while if the court isn't going to agree to a bright line rule, it should certainly not on its face, just on the record we have, enforce the class action waiver as we know it, but what we know. So, and in addition, just some of the comments that were made by, I want to address Justice Wehner Appner's questions about arbitration. Like, wouldn't this be, if you strike down class action waivers in court, wouldn't that just encourage arbitration? When my colleague spoke and said we're there already, what she was alluding to is, you know, in reviewing contracts every day, people come into my office wanting to pursue a case. First question I have is on a class action basis. First question I have is, did you agree to an arbitration clause? 50% of the time, people don't know what that is. I'm like, well, do you have an agreement you signed? Review the agreement. And 90% of the time, there's already a class action waiver in the agreement. We're there, meaning we're dealing with that already. It's very seldom that there's not some type of class action waiver. I can represent to this court and doing this for 27 years.
Were you saying it's very seldom that there's not binding arbitration, or were you saying that it's very seldom that there is no requirement to have binding arbitration, but there's still a class action waiver?
No,
I'll
make it clear. I'm sorry. Yeah, 90% of the time there is a class action arbitration clause in the agreement that I review. We've reviewed over 2,000, basically every.
That means, 90% of the time, binding arbitration is required, and there's a class action waiver in binding arbitration.
Correct. We're there. That's there already, and so you try to defeat it because it's not absolute. Under Adelise, you can defeat a class action arbitration clause if it's not drafted appropriately. Defendants have gotten adept at drafting enforceable agreements, but there are times where we're still able to defeat it. When you're in court, I've only seen class action waivers in court two times in my entire career without an arb clause. This case and one case about 15 years ago, there are not class action waivers without arb clauses present in agreements all over the state. You just don't see it. I think that's in part for a couple of reasons. One, I think for defendants, like why take the risk? If they want to avoid a class action, just put it into an arb clause and litigate an arbitration. The other is, I think if they have counsel and they're aware of Muhammad and they do business with small claims, they would know that perhaps it may not be enforceable, especially if they're using form contracts for low cost services or products. So, but Muhammad still has been good law, and there's still the Rudbard analysis, and that would fail. So the point is, you know, if class action waivers, and again, I don't think the court's going there, as Justice Patterson pointed out, you know, our concern from NJAJ is just not a blanket ruling that class action waivers are just okay in court. I mean, I think at a minimum, our concern is that we would want there at a minimum to be the Rudbard analysis that's articulated in Muhammad. We don't think that the bright line rule expressed by this court in this case is that overreaching, only in that, as I explained with Muhammad, the practical effect of Muhammad is that while not expressed, it sort of is a bright line rule because you typically only have small damages claims that often arise out of a contract of adhesion that are ripe for class actions. And so technically you'd have to really kind of search long and hard, when would a Rudbard analysis under Muhammad not apply? And as Justice Patterson pointed out, Delta funding, but that's a $100,000 claim. A person who has a $100,000 claim, frankly, is not gonna care if they could pursue a class action or not. Their case, they'll be able to get an attorney on a contingent basis. and be able to pursue their claim individually. It's more the smaller claims.
Delta Funding suggested very strongly that class actions, the class action waivers are not per se unenforceable.
And in that case, Justice Patterson, I agree. I mean, it wouldn't be appropriate in that case. Just practically, I don't know how many cases with persons with $100,000 claims are concerned about a class action. That's sort of like a one-off. But you know, I understand that the court did say that, and I understand why. In terms of just looking at some of the defenses articulated by the defendants, you know, after hearing their arguments, we're not in a lot of disagreement that, you know, I think our position is that at a minimum, Muhammad and the Rudbert analysis should apply. They're arguing that the Muhammad and Rudbert analysis should apply. I think that does it apply in this case, and that the court has to look at. I think for the reasons I already articulated, I think at a minimum, it's hard to say, but if the court had to lean one way or the other, I think this tends to be closer to a contract of adhesion based on the facts that we argued, even though these people may be sophisticated, don't really know how much ability they had to negotiate. And it looks like it's a small damages claim. While it's not a $50 claim or $200 claim, it's not, I don't think it's more than a $5,000 or $6,000 claim, which puts you right above the small claims limit. So it still fits in there.
You're not suggesting that if it is a contract of adhesion, that it's unenforceable per se, are you?
Not the whole agreement. I'm specifically talking about the class action. Right. I'm specifically talking about the class action waiver, and I'm also specifically talking about, you know, if this was a Delta Funding type of situation where the claim was a $200,000 claim, yeah, I don't think we'd be here. I think it would easily go forward as an individual claim. There would be no problem. I think what makes this case interesting to discuss and a little tougher to look at is what is the value of the claim. I mean, if the claim really is, you know, as Ms. Edelstein talked about, if the cost of a security person to provide the 24/7 service is a salary of, you know, $50,000 spread amongst 500 people over the course of the year, and that's what they're not getting, that is well under $1,000 claim per person, or about $1,000 claim per person. Even if you treble it, it's $3,000. I mean, so would a $3,000 case proceed on its own? I mean, there is one person pursuing one. Would a case normally? I mean, the problem with this, looking at this case is, and for this court is, this decision here is going to have much farther reach than just this case. And that's what's the concern of NJAJ.
Yeah, we have your position. Other questions that among the justices? Anything you'd like to add in closing?
No. Thank you, justices, for taking the time. Thank you for still hearing us today despite the weather. And we appreciate it. Thank you.
NJAJ. Mr. Ruggiero, rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Justices, I'll be very brief. It sounds like we're all in agreement that there should be no bright line rule either way, and we're not advocating for one, and we think the appellate division's bright line rule should be reversed. I agree with Justice Patterson's suggestion that I think the appellate division went too far here. Nobody argued for a bright line rule. There was no motion for class certification before the appellate division. It didn't need to reach the issue, and it certainly didn't need to say that a class action waiver is certainly favored here. We disagree with that. There's not evidence before the court for that finding, and the court went too far. We certainly feel that even if the class action waiver is not enforced here, class certification is not appropriate. Individualized issues here are going to predominate. Class certifications based on oral promises, as suggested in the plaintiff's complaint, are just inherently problematic because it depends upon what was said, to whom, what was relied upon. So oral promises are generally disfavored when it comes to class actions and class certification. In addition, it sounds like now there's going to be some concerns about ascertainable loss and whether or not the plaintiff's ascertainable loss is viable or even typical of the other plaintiffs in this case, based upon what we're hearing. So class certification in this case is not appropriate. The appellate division went too far.
If it was inappropriate for the appellate division to say, this looks like it should be certified, is it appropriate for us to debate whether it shouldn't be certified in resolving this appeal?
Yes, under the enforcement of the class action waiver analysis, because we can enforce the class action waiver, which would, if the class action waiver is enforced, then class certification is inappropriate because the waiver bars class certification. So we can certainly reach that on this record and pursuant to the principles articulated in Delta Funding and Muhammad. I also want to note that this court can absolutely make a ruling on the unconscionability analysis under Rudbard on the pleadings and based on what's before it.
Can I just pause here? We're in response to the chief's question, were you saying that this court can make a ruling on the waiver as barring class certification, but you're not suggesting the court should be opining on how the class certification issue would come out in this case individually, are you? Given the fact that nobody's moved for it, there hasn't been discovery, and nobody's gone through the 432.1 and 2 process.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And I apologize if that was suggested by my argument. A determination of whether or not class certification is appropriate under Rule 4:32 is not appropriate for this court at this juncture based on those factors. However, a determination that the class action waiver is enforceable and therefore there can be no class certification because the plaintiff here agreed to pursue their claims individually and not either as a representative or a member of a class, that decision could certainly be made because under the appropriate analysis, the class action waivers are valid and binding and enforceable on the plaintiffs in this case.
What do we do with the fact that there seems to be a dispute, a polite collegial dispute, but nonetheless a dispute as to the value of this, potential value of this claim?
So there's two points I want to make. First, in declaring the plaintiffs have the burden to prove that the provision is unconscionable, right? So if they can't prove the value of their damages, and they can't meet their burden of showing that it's unconscionable, this court should hold that it is, that the provision can be enforced. And in addition, the plaintiffs have the burden under the CFA to prove ascertainable loss. In the ascertainable loss, I was a little bit confused by counsel's argument because it was focusing on the defendant's value, but really the ascertainable loss as stated in their complaint and under the statute really should be focusing on the value to the plaintiffs and what the plaintiffs lost. So any discussion as to what the value of the 24/7 security to the defendants, I think, is misplaced. It really should focus on what's the value of the 24/7 security to the plaintiffs and were the plaintiffs deprived of that value. And in doing that analysis, here's what we know. Each lease agreement was for over $3,600 for more than 26 months. And the total pot, the total value, the total amount of damages at issue is $90,000. If they say that the lease agreements were totally invalid, then they would arguably be entitled to a $90,000 refund. I don't think they're going that far. Counsel hasn't said that. So it's somewhere in between. But the pot of money from which we can look at is over $90,000 for each plaintiff. And that's significant. And that's why this goes to Delta Funding and is a far cry from Muhammad. In addition, I just want to note, this is not a case of first impression under New Jersey. Judge Martinotti's decision in Horowitz also discussed New Jersey law. And he indicated that the class action waivers could be valid and enforceable under the principles articulated in Delta Funding and Muhammad and Arefa. And just finally, one last point, I think I noted it before, this court can make the determination that the class action waivers are valid and enforceable. And on the pleadings, no further discovery is necessary or warranted. And the Kiefer versus High Point Insurance case really holds that. No fact-sensitive inquiry is required for the first procedural Rudbard factors. And the public interest factor here can be gleaned from the face of the complaint. And we know that the public interest factor here does not override the interest of freedom of contract and upholding the class action waivers in this case.
Mr. Ruggiero, one question. You told us in your argument earlier that you estimated this claim was valued at $5,600. Your adversary tells us it's less. Are you now asking us to consider this as a $90,000 claim? That's how some of your argument just resonated.
My apologies, Your Honor. I'm not indicating that this is a $90,000 claim, nor in Delta Funding did the court say that was a $100,000 claim. The court in Delta Funding didn't specifically know whether the amount of damages at $100,000 was going to be trebled or not. It simply knew that there was a claim against a $100,000 loan agreement. Here, there is a claim against lease agreements that the full value is worth $90,000.
And is that what you're asking us to focus on? It seems at odds with the arguments that both parties have presented.
Well, I'm just pointing to a fact in the record of the full value of the lease. What I really like would like the court to focus on is our previous argument that even under the most conservative approach, a $5,200 or $5,600 amount is more than significant for an individual plaintiff to bring a claim under the CFA. And that's because of the provisions for treble damages and provisions for attorney's fees. So claims as low as $3,000 or $5,000, the class action waivers, enforcing class action waivers for those claims will not act as exculpatory clauses. It's only claims in which we have a $40 diet drug or a $200 payday loan. Those small value claims would never be brought into court of law. A $3,000 claim could be brought in the small claims part. A $5,600 claim could be brought in the special civil part. Under the CFA, attorneys can and do take those cases.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful argument.